Hello and welcome to Hot Girls Code, a podcast all about the tech industry, software development, and being a woman in tech. I'm your host, Lola.
And I am your host, Aughty. So today we have a very exciting interview for you all. We are chatting to Winona Naramalefa. So Winona started off her career in tech as a data analyst before making the shift to user experience design. And these are two roles that we will chat a bit more about in this episode.
She is a passionate advocate for increasing representation of Pacific women in tech, and she uses her own experiences from her Niuean and Cook Island heritage to help design more inclusive solutions, which we absolutely love.
Winona is a deeply passionate tech enthusiast, and she's a self-proclaimed nerd, having not one but two masters, one in future technologies and one in user experience design. And I think that is so cool. Not just one master's, but two.
We loved our chat with Winona. She was an absolute trooper, sitting down to chat with us even though she was recovering from being ill. But that didn't stop her from really digging into some super great topics and discussions.
And with all that wonderful hype, I'm sure you all listening are super excited to get into the episode, so let's get into the interview.
Welcome to Hot Girls Code, Winona. We are so excited to have you on the show today. Now, to begin with, we would love to just break the ice with a couple of quick icebreaker questions. So the first question we have is, what was your dream job as a kid?
I wanted to be a marine biologist because dolphins, like literally there is no other answer. And I used to collect the files that you would get each week on different animals. And so I just decided I was going to be a marine biologist and then never ever looked at that career path again.
That's so cool. And I feel like that's like a surprisingly common career that kids want to have. And I wonder where all those like potential marine biologists are today. I guess maybe they're in tech.
Yeah, because I definitely wanted to be a marine biologist after watching H2O Just Add Water, like the mermaid show. I was like, I could be a marine biologist.
It does look so cool, but at a recent conference, I met this wonderful, wonderful friend now, and she is a marine biologist in Papua New Guinea, and she works with, I think they're river dolphins. So when she told me what she did, I was like, oh my gosh, you are living my dream.
Oh my gosh, that's absolutely amazing. Moving on to our next icebreaker question, what is one item you would take with you to a desert island? Assuming you have like food and water and all of those things, because we don't want a boring answer like that.
Do you know, I was going to say a musical instrument like a guitar, but I can't play the guitar. So I don't know why I would want to take that. But
a great time to learn it, you know, give it a go.
That is a very fair answer. And I feel like something to entertain yourself is like a really good choice. But to finish off with our final quickfire question and ending on a bit of a wholesome note, what's something on your desk or at a nearby wall or out the window that cheers you up during the day?
It would be this like really weird apple that's behind me. It's called a happy apple, but when we were cleaning up my grandparents' house in Aitutaki, which is in the Cook Islands, they had everything that from when my dad and his siblings were born, and this happened to be one of them, which is like a Fisher & Paykel apple. And I asked if I could have it, and it makes me happy. And it's kind of creepy and kind of weird, and it just sits in my lounge.
Does it have a use, a purpose at all, or is it just a decoration that's just fun?
So it, like, rolls, and it makes us weird. No, it just sounds like a creepy toy. But I don't know. It's just weird. It's such a funny thing to have in the lounge, but it's great when my friends bring their kids over.
Oh my gosh, I love that. For anyone that couldn't hear, I don't know if your mic managed to pick it up. It was like a weird haunting melody, like a little lullaby almost being played while you swayed this apple back and forth, which I think is iconic.
And I love the fact that it has like sentimental value, because if you see it, it just looks like this creepy, like crazy little apple friend. I love it though.
So now that we're feeling all wholesome, or maybe creeped out, who knows, either one. And we're ready to get into the crux of the interview. Could you start off by telling us a bit about your career journey and how you got into tech?
So, kia ora, my name is Winona Naramalefa, and I am a digital product designer. at the bank, and previously I was a data analyst. So my journey into tech is quite weird. When I was younger, they had this pilot program, which is now called Manaiakalani in Auckland. And so they teach lower decile schools about technology. And so that's how we were kind of introduced to it. And it was really, really exciting then. But then in intermediate and high school, I wasn't really encouraged to do anything around tech. So I kind of tried a whole lot of things and failed a lot. And I think that's like my favorite thing to say is like I failed 4 attempts at a degree.
What were the 4 attempts that you made?
It was communications, which for a really nerdy person like myself now makes sense why it wouldn't, you know, like why I would fail so often. But to walk into a room and to do so many group projects when you're like a really nerdy introverted person, it makes sense now why it didn't work out for me. But so I failed quite a lot, and then I decided to move overseas and with my husband, and I taught myself how to code websites, so just basic stuff like HTML and CSS. Then I realized I really love tech, and I forgot that that was something that I enjoyed and something I loved. And so after that I started exploring tech, and I was just really fortunate to get into one of the master's programs in Auckland and start to explore disruptive technology, and started looking at big data, and then looked at Pacific and Māori women coming into the tech industry and what that looked like, and looking at frameworks. And so from there I started to build and became a data analyst for a while. And then I realized I was handing off the data so they could build the solutions. And I was like, no, I want to build it. And they're like, you can't, that's not your job. So I did another master's at Vic Uni, and it focused on UX. And now I get to actually come up with the solutions for the data that comes across. But yeah, tech was something that I had to find again.
I love that you like had this passion as a child, and then, you know, it kind of went away for a while. You got distracted by some other things, but then this passion ultimately like found you again, and you did end up in tech. And it's really cool, like what you said about failing, because that's something I think we are really passionate about on the podcast. And that's the fact that if you don't fail, you don't learn, and then you don't eventually succeed.
Definitely. And I also really respect the fact that you were like, oh, you say I can't do this because it's not my job. Let me just casually go get my second master's so that I can do that.
2 masters. That is insane. What was that like?
It was really interesting. I think because I had failed so often, I was quite scared that I would fail again. I'm really fortunate to have parents who have the breadth and width to allow me to fail and still support me to keep going, and then also my husband and my family and my brothers. So it was just really interesting to get back into academia, because I was like, that's not me. But I do think that failure builds resilience, and Angela Duckworth wrote that amazing book called Grit, and it's all about how actually the thing that sets people apart is the ability to get back up after failing, or get back up after something that gets you down. And so I think those knockbacks meant that when I went back in, I was kind of a lot more prepared to take these on. And I love studying. Like, I really want to do my PhD, but I think I'm going to give my husband a bit of time, because he was just like the solo breadwinner for quite a while. And I think he's enjoying having 2 incomes. So I'll give him a bit of a break, and then I'll go back in and see what I can do. Yeah.
That is so cool.
That is amazing. And I think we are going to ask another question about your master's later. But for now, just going back to your first role in the tech industry as a data analyst, what do you actually do as a data analyst, and how was that experience for you?
Yeah, data analysis was interesting, especially when you're coming in at entry level. I think there's a lot of imposter syndrome, and then can I do this, and am I supposed to be here? And then it's quite male dominated. Well, it was in the workplace that I was in. So coming into it, I realized that you have to really just be open to failing again. So not knowing all the answers and being able to lean in and ask your colleagues and the people who are there for help and how to get things done, because there was a little bit of time in there where I took it all upon myself. And so I'd be like, definitely doing all these courses outside of work and double checking that I could, you know, run SQL and that I could pull this data and that it was correct. But really it's a lot easier when you have teammates who are willing to help you and coach you. So a lot of the time when I was a data analyst, it was extracting data for a lot of, we work quite closely with the board, with our ELT to make sure that they had data for the presentations that they were going into.
Going back to how you used to be a data analyst and then you shifted to UX, you spoke about how you did your master's to kind of enable that shift. Was there anything else about kind of what that journey was like that you, you know, remember, like what prompted it? What were some of the challenges with shifting roles within the tech industry?
I think it's hard for some people, their whole career is based on the first thing that they studied or the first industry that they got into. So you bring all this wealth of knowledge, but then again, you're kind of starting from the beginning again. So that transition can be a little bit hard. And I think a bit of humility, really, you know, because if you stayed in that career, you could definitely just keep going up and climbing. But going sideways in a career means that you kind of have to start a little bit at the beginning. And so that has meant a lot of humility. And again, being open to lean in and go, okay, I'm not an expert, but I get to learn from these amazing people. And how do I take these opportunities and just run with them and do the very best work that I can?
Do you feel like the technical skills or like the previous skills that you'd had as a data analyst kind of helped you with that transition at all?
Yeah, I definitely think that what I know from data has really pulled through into UX. There is a superpower in all the things that you learn, whether they be, you know, academically or the things that you have learned just culturally or growing up. So there is an edge where when people bring data, I can start to analyze it and go, are you sure this is correct? Where did you pull this from? And then I can obviously pull my own data sometimes if we need to, which means a little less time waiting for other people. But I think that goes the same for technical. So in my first master's, I created a game with one of our friends in Unity, so using C#. And I think understanding technical, like, just the basic building blocks of how to do things set you up for UX to have those conversations. I'm definitely a UX designer who likes to work quite closely with developers and then also allow them to push back and go, hey, I don't know about this. And then for me to be able to push back as well and go, hey, I think you've said technical limitations. I think it might be a time thing because I know that you can't do that.
Call them out.
Yeah, which is great. Like, because sometimes when people say, oh, no, we can't do that, and if you don't have that knowledge, you're kind of like, okay, well, we can't.
Yeah, you just have to accept it because they said that. But I love that because you had that those technical skills to begin with, that's given you, like, this new ability as a UX designer to actually say, hey, I know you guys can do that. Like, what gives? Moving on, we would love to talk a wee bit more about your current role and also just the wonders of user experience, aka UX. So firstly, for any of our listeners who don't know, would you mind just explaining what exactly UX is?
Yeah, UX stands for user experience. Some people who study it go into more service design roles. The one I'm in is more in a digital product role. And what we do is a bit of, so people think we just design the screens, that's UI, which is user interface. We do that as well as working along our researcher or sometimes doing the research ourselves to better understand what it is the customers need, what the business requirements are, and how we're going to build a solution for that. And then it goes from like the initial conception. And if anyone who's in UX will be like the double diamond. So it's like thinking about the problem and then going wide and ideating with everyone and coming back in to design the solution. So from beginning to the end, till you hand off to the wonderful full stack developers and then seeing that into production.
Awesome. I love that explanation. We were initially like, oh, should we try to explain what it is? We were like, I feel like she'll give a much better answer. And you definitely did. We would have just been like, oh, they designed the user experience. Duh.
Obviously. I feel like you definitely gave it justice more so than we would have. So thank you for that explanation.
So hopefully our listeners kind of get a better grasp of what you do. And we wanted to ask what you enjoy the most about being a UX designer, or just a few of the things you enjoy about it.
The most fun thing about it is the feedback that people have and the feedback that customers have, we're the team that gets to work on it and start to fix some of those issues that you may have or make it more fun. And seeing the stuff in production is actually really cool, because the amount of time people have gone, oh, like, yeah, I used the app for the previous company I worked for, and there was this really cool feature in there, and for me to go, oh my gosh, I made that, you know, like, yeah. I don't know if we get to be like, that was me, but it's a real nice, like, brush your shoulder off kind of like, yeah, that was us.
And now that we know a wee bit more about what a UX designer actually does and what you enjoy about that role, we'd love to hear about kind of what a day in the life of looks like for you. Like, what do you do in the day-to-day as a UX designer?
The first thing that I do in the morning is usually stand up. So if you're embedded in a team, what will happen is you'll do a meeting with all the people who are involved in the project. And then after that, any meetings that you need to attend to according to that project. And if not, then in between those meetings, there's a lot of meetings. I think people underestimate how many meetings there are when you work in tech. In between all those meetings, you also do the work, which could be anything from like preparing screens for research or doing research analysis based on what you've just tested, to wireframing or creating the actual like finished product. So yeah, but a lot of meetings.
That's so funny, because like one of the things Auti and I talk about quite a lot is how one of the things we didn't expect when we joined tech is actually how collaborative it is and how often you are working with other people. So I love that, like, you're coming on as UX designer being like, yeah, I'm in meetings like a lot of the time, like communicating with all of these people and like working with the team. It is a lot more collaborative than people think, eh?
It is so collaborative. You know, most of the time you're working with your developers, you're working with your product owners, your scrum masters, your line managers, there's just so many people, your stakeholders. So everyone really delivers the project. When you stand back at the end of the day, it's not like a me project or a you project. Most of the time, it's a whole team that have worked nonstop and been in meetings nonstop to get these final products out. And that's really exciting as well, to stand back as a team and go, yeah, we did that.
I also love how, Lola, you did a little spin on meetings being a collaborative, positive thing, when I know for a fact we had an episode, we were interviewing you, Lola, and you spoke about how you changed back to being a developer because there were too many meetings in your other role.
Too many meetings is bad. Some meetings is good. Like, if my day has no meetings, then I feel like there's just no structure.
So moving on from a debate about meetings and how important they are, a very hot topic at the moment is, of course, AI. And Lola and I actually recently went to a conference, and one of the talks was about how there's lots of cool new generative AI tools out there and how UX designers can be using them in tech. I was wondering, what do you think are some of the ways that AI will impact UX design?
This is a really great question, because there are some really great articles and then there's some scary articles, you know, and I think a lot of the world sees the scary articles, and because they don't understand tech, they're like, oh, it's all downhill from there. But I think AI can be a really great tool, and we already see it coming through the software that we use, Figma and Adobe mostly. They have a lot of generative AI at the moment. Some of it in beta, so it will automatically spin up templates for you. It will help you put together like organizational charts or flows, depending on how things marry together within the product. That is just the beginning of what AI is going to do. I think there also is a responsibility as a UX designer to start to think about how you can incorporate this a bit more, and it does take a little bit of upskilling. But I love generative AI. It's so helpful and useful, but I do think, oh my gosh, what does the future actually look like? Not just what I read, not just what I see right here, but how crazy is it going to get in the future?
You mentioned before that you wanted to maybe get your PhD. Do you think you might do it in something like AI or generative AI?
I would be really interested. I had a great opportunity this year to sit on the Women in AI Asia Pacific Awards and look at what some of the things that are coming out of it. And I would love to have more diversity as far as like designing AI and how it's developed. So if there is a way for me to get my PhD with an AI focus, then I'm all for it. And I would definitely be open to exploring it and seeing what we can do there.
It would be so cool. And I love that you're talking about how important it is to have diversity in AI, because I was reading this article the other day and it was about the company OpenAI, which runs like ChatGPT and lots of other things, and about how their company makeup was majority men. And it's like, if it is just men and no people of color that are writing the software for these new features, like, what's going to happen? You know, it's not going to be a good thing. So I think it's, yeah, really important to highlight, and that would be amazing for you. But moving forward into another thing that we know you're really passionate about, we would love to talk a wee bit about diversity and intersectionality. So you being a gorgeous woman of colour in tech, we're imagining that you're no stranger to the importance and value of diversity throughout the tech process. So why do you think diversity is important in UX design specifically?
The UX space is really interesting. I mean, for digital products or even service design, you're looking at how you develop or how you build things for customers. And if we're building for the same type of customer all the time, then we miss out on a whole lot of perspective. But also for people who are like, well, who cares about perspective? Like, the bottom line is, when it comes to business revenue, you want as many customers as possible. That means you're designing for a range of people and for what the current climate of New Zealand looks like and what the world looks like. And so you're missing out on opportunities to reach communities, to reach women, to really tap into these markets. I just think there's such a big opportunity for user experience to continue to advocate for those voices. But again, I think I know about four Pacific UX designers in New Zealand, and one of them's my brother. If we're creating products that serve like millions of customers or even 100,000 customers, and there's no voice like ours advocating for that, then those can be blind spots that people miss when they're going into testing, when they're going into developing, when they're going into creating these solutions. So yeah, I think it's really important for us to have that diverse perspective and knowledge and just wealth of wisdom coming into these things, because we all have blind spots. And so why not do something that's great for the bottom line and great for the people?
Who knew you can like help people and be a good capitalist?
It's like, how do I sell it to you so that you also want to do it?
Yeah, I feel like a book that we've mentioned a few times on the podcast that talks a lot about this as well is Invisible Women by Caroline Criado Perez. I don't know if you've ever read it before, but it's basically about how there's just such a big data gap when it comes to women in so many areas in the world and what we see. And I just remember every time I read that book, because I've read it a few times, I get so mad. I just get so mad. And I'm like, why would people think that like it's logical to just not, like, it's so easy to include diverse voices, at least at some point along the way, and they don't even do that.
The other thing about that book was just, it reminds you how many products are made with women just not being thought about at all. Like, the whole experience and the whole design is purely made for men. So I think it's really cool that you're pointing out, like, the importance of diversity in UX design is that we can cater to all of these different perspectives. And that's why diversity is so important.
Yeah, it's such a big conversation, eh? But look, the more women that you have in these roles, just the better it's going to be.
Just the more diverse in general just makes such a difference. So a term that some of our listeners may or may not be familiar with is intersectionality, and we wanted to dive into this a bit more now. But before we do, if there's anyone that's not familiar with this term or isn't sure what it means, we found a great definition on the internet, so I'm going to use that one. So intersectionality is the acknowledgement that everyone has their own unique experiences of discrimination and oppression, and we must consider everything and anything that can marginalize people. So it's about not just focusing on one thing. It's not just about gender discrimination. It could be gender, race, class, sexual orientation, physical ability. So if you hadn't heard the term intersectionality, now you have. And with that in mind, We wanted to chat to you, Winona, about why you think an intersectional lens matters in tech.
I think it would go back to the thing I said before around like a diverse range of perspectives. But then there are so many other things and layers that come with a person. And, you know, when you create things like personas, sometimes it doesn't cover intersectionality and it misses out on a whole range of things that come with that person. I think it's really important because our lived experiences also make up who we are. Like, we're all three of us are a woman on the podcast, but we're all quite different. And so you can't say that intersectionality doesn't play a role in that. You couldn't say we were three of the same. In some ways, yes. But if we don't bring in our lived experiences for everyone, then again, we miss out on that perspective and that richness that comes from having all of these experiences and knowing firsthand why it would make sense for this community or why it would make sense to do something this way. And I don't know. It's really hard to answer because, you know, on the outset, it's just better for everyone. But, you know.
You feel like it should be intuitive, but for some reason, it's not for everyone.
Yeah, it's just such a weird thing, eh? Because you're like advocating and then you're like, oh, like just do it.
I think that's a really fair point. I do think sometimes it can feel frustrating when there's something that you like deeply believe so strongly and it feels like, well, it's just the right answer, not just because of morality, but also, like you said earlier, like financially, it also feels like the most correct answer, and yet people fight back against it or are a bit reluctant about it or don't see the value in it, and that can feel just a bit like infuriating.
Yeah, and I think actually coming back to that question again, there's one thing that I know for sure. It was very easy for me to not understand why people didn't think the same. You know, like, you believe in this, so why isn't everyone getting on board? But I think there's also beauty in agreeing to disagree with people and being able to live in cohesion with each other. And there's kind of this like movement where if we all don't think the same thing or believe in the same thing or do the same thing, that, you know, you get cancelled or we shouldn't be friends or we shouldn't work together. But we are intersectionally different. So there also has to be grace that we give and extend towards each other to live and to work together, because it brings out that richness in ourselves as well. So yeah, I think there's also that element that I would love to see more people go, oh cool, I don't agree with this person on everything. I don't agree with them. You know, we may not have the same faith or we may not have the same beliefs and things, but they're a great person. So how do we coexist with each other in a harmonious way? And I think we can achieve that by starting to go, okay, not everyone thinks like me. Not everyone's lived like me. Not everyone's grown up like me.
That's so true. And I feel like that's a really great just appreciation of what intersectionality is. I'd love to chat a wee bit more about you personally and yourself as a wonderful Pacifica woman in tech. We're wondering, how do you feel like the different parts of your identity have helped you in your career?
Being a Pacifica woman is part of, I would say, our superpower, and everyone has one. But we're a very collaborative by nature people. And so there's a whole lot of empathy that comes along with what we do culturally. There's also like a really great aspect of relationship building that comes into this. And I think being one of very few within the tech industry, we currently make up less than 1% statistically. And so I hope, and the reason why I go on panels, even though I'm like awkward and weird, and the reason I go to tech talks is because I hope in the future that another young, weird brown girl sees me and goes, oh my gosh, I can do it because she's doing it. So we came here and my grandparents came here, my parents came here so that we could have all of these opportunities, and everything that we do is about the future generations. And so it means so much to me, and I am so proud to be Niuean, Cook Island, have parents who came from the islands, and be in a tech industry and be doing what I do. And sitting here amongst you two and just having these conversations, because it's like what my grandparents could only have dreamed of, opportunities like this for us. So yeah, I'm just so proud to be a Pacific woman.
That is so beautiful. And now we have kind of on the flip side of that, we're wondering, have there been times where you've felt that you've been held back by aspects of your identity? And how did you overcome that when that happened?
There's definitely a flip side to this. Sometimes it feels that you have to work twice as hard. And I know it's not just a Pacific female thing. I know that a lot of other women in tech feel this. But you can't just walk into a room and be good because you're good at it. You almost have to be great. And you have to work two times harder to make sure that your opinion is valid, to make sure that what you're bringing to the table is just as good, if not better. And I think that can be really hard. And then there's also what we would call a cultural tax. So it's when you're expected to do your job, but on top of that, do a whole lot of things for your community. And that's great because we believe so much in our community. And we believe so much in the future generations. But the downside of that is that it's work on top of work. So burnout can come on quite quickly.
Yeah, it can be quite tricky. And I, like, this is something that I've like spoken about before with like people in my life, because sometimes it can feel like, oh, I really want to succeed like in my job and stand here for my merit, but also I really value giving back to the community that I like come from, and I really value inspiring other people because I too was inspired and I want to be able to do that for others. And it can be, yeah, it can be exhausted. You feel like you're doing like 150% rather than just 100%. And you feel like in order to only be doing 100%, you have to either give up career growth or give up, you know, giving back. And it's a really hard trade-off.
Yeah, it's a really hard trade-off. And I wouldn't say that I know the secret yet. And I don't know if there is one. But great managers is something that's really helpful. And people who can see that it contributes to your progression, or it contributes to building the profile of a company or of your team. So yeah, that's one thing that's been really helpful for me, to try and counter doing 150%.
Now we are coming up to the end of this episode, so it's time to move into our quick fire questions. So our first quick fire question is, what's the best job you've ever had and why?
Nature Discovery, which is like a educational kids store, and cleaning the pharmacy was my first job. So the reason I would choose both of them is there's so many cool educational kids toys that I didn't know about, and it unlocked like this love for science that I didn't know that I had based on kids toys. So that was very, very cool.
I loved Nature Discovery when I was a kid, and I feel like you've just brought back like all of these memories. I remember when you'd go in there, at least in the store from where I grew up, it was like a little cave and you could go in and they had like stars on the ceiling and like all these cool science kits.
Yeah, I feel like you unlocked a core memory there, because I was like, Nature Discovery, what's that? And then as soon as you explained it, I was like, that was my favorite shop as a child. So you mentioned that when you'd moved overseas, you taught yourself some coding and, you know, upskilled a bit there. We know you don't do coding in your day-to-day job anymore, but casting your mind back to then, what did you enjoy the most about coding?
I think the fact that I thought I couldn't do it, and to realize actually I can, and the set of instructions. And I always laugh because when I talk to people about, because I did JavaScript 101 as one of my papers, and I was talking about the instructions that our grandparents give us and how they give us a set of instructions and you do it, and the only time you ask a question is when something doesn't go right. And I was saying that it's quite similar to code, and that the fact that if you get it right, nothing will come back to you, but if you don't get it right, then it's going to yell at you and be like, hey, this isn't right. And that's exactly like going the shopping for my grandma. It's like, hey, that's not the thing that I asked you for. And I'll be like, oh, what did you ask for?
I love that. Now, in a kind of similar vein, you've talked about how you did a bit of HTML, CSS, and you did this JavaScript 101 course. So what was the first coding language that you learned?
HTML.
I think that's been the answer that pretty much everyone has given. Like HTML, it's a very common place to start off.
Yeah, exactly. I think we've only had one person that has said something different to HTML and CSS. And she did start in the tech industry like 30 years ago. So maybe that's why. Back to our quick fire questions. What do you think is your biggest strength in your career?
I think my biggest strength is understanding the technical language that goes behind data and some of the language that we use and being able to make it really easy to understand for our customers. I think we should be shouldering all of that technicality and giving it back to them in a way that they understand. So that would be my biggest strength, I think.
That is a great strength to have. And our second to last question, what is one thing that you wish you knew before you got into tech?
Really feel like it should be a serious answer, but all I can think of is I wish I knew that tech has the most free food and drink available at their meetups and they always have the best perks.
That is the best answer, though. It's honest, it's genuine, and you know what, some people are going to listen to that and that may be the thing that makes them be like, you know what, I'm going to get into tech.
Honestly, that is fair. Like, I would say the same thing.
It's always got good stuff.
And our final quick fire question is, what is the final piece of advice that you would have for girls that are considering a career in tech?
If I was to give advice, I would probably use what my dad says, which is, he says it about Pacifica, but it also applies to women, that we're not a problem to be solved, we're potential to be realized. And I think realizing your potential is a massive thing, and you are so worth being in that room. Take all the space that you need and lean into each other, because all the women in tech that I know, we're always willing to like cheer each other on. So slide into the LinkedIn DMs and have a conversation.
That is such a powerful message, and what a wonderful note to end on. So that is a wrap from all the questions from us. Thank you so much for coming onto the show and chatting with us today, Winona. It's been amazing to hear your insights and just learn more about you, because you are such a cool human.
So nice. Thank you so much.
And that brings us to the end of today's episode. We hope you all enjoyed our chat with Winona as much as we did. I feel like we really learned a lot and we're feeling super inspired. Our next episode is all about three places you wouldn't expect to find bias in tech. So be sure to check that out when it comes out in a fortnight.
As always, if you enjoyed this episode, we would really appreciate it if you would share it with your friends or on social media to help us spread the word and get Hot Girls Code to more wonderful women.
We'd also love it if you could leave us a rating and subscribe to Hot Girls Code wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you need some more Hot Girls Code in your life, you can also follow us on Instagram and TikTok under @hot_girls_code to keep up to date with the podcast and learn more about the tech industry, software development, and being a woman in tech.
Thanks for listening.